This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Well, good evening, everyone, and thanks for sticking around. My name is Patrice Pietro, and I'm here with award-winning documentary filmmaker Anthony Banua-Simon. So, to start, I had just a general question. Your film explores how Hawaii has been represented as an exotic yet familiar paradise, mostly for non-Hawaiian audiences. You return to several Hollywood classic films to expose their racism and colonizing practices, but you seem less interested, given our theme here this year, revisiting the classics at the Pollock Theater. You're less interested in revisiting these as classic films than exploring how cinema is related to political life on the island. Can you tell us more about your approach here? I mean, clearly, you invoke but depart from Hollywood conventions.
Sure, yeah. I was looking at these films, and I think the general approach that, oh, this is an escape, a backdrop for some sort of exotic location, was kind of something that had been talked about for a while, and that was interesting. But I think what first stood out to me was a series of films that were made really deliberately, and what was the ideology behind it? You know, it first started with the sugar companies as PR to, you know, trying to bring in the idea of statehood. And how, you know, what were the material circumstances that were motivating this? What was the ideologies that were being explored? And so I started looking at every film that was shot on Kauai and put them into different categories. And I was influenced by Tom Anderson's essay film, Los Angeles Plays Itself, where he does the same thing, but he does films that are filmed in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And he divides it into Los Angeles as a subject, Los Angeles as a character. And so that's where I started to kind of break it down as, okay, is Kauai, you know, is the labor movement being addressed in this era, or is it representing another country, another place that doesn't even exist, that's tropical, mm-hmm. and worked through there. And I wanted to use that as a framework to kind of as work in parallel with these other material histories that were interesting to me. And I never knew exactly how one would comment on the other. So I always kind of kept them as these separate timelines. So someone that I would talk to would suddenly bring up a film that I had never thought about, and I would kind of see if they would play off of each other. And, you know, these films are, you know, I don't want to discredit them because they're dated or they have dated, you know, representational of people, but, you know, they're films that have nuance and have their own life, and people have complicated relationships to them, especially people born and raised in Hawaii that may have a conflicted nostalgia where they see a place that they're associated with and they take what they can from it. So I wanted to not completely discard the films, but kind of work them in the kind of the initial energy that they had, and, you know, how to use kind of the thrust or some of the kitsch value as an entry point to things that are kind of harder to talk about, hard to break into, you know, how to talk about sovereignty politics and labor politics, and have Elvis included somehow, and as kind of a tease to bring you in, like, oh, what was going on? I think that no matter how these productions were controlled, they still had these moments of rupture of things they can't control. That kind of, I was always looking for these little moments that kind of slipped outside of the frame, and how I could rechannel that, recontextualize what was going on.
Yeah. Well, it leads me to my second question. Because what comes into view over the course of the film are the historical relationships between the plantation economy, the film industry, and tourism. Clearly, the practices of racial segregation innovated on the plantation carry over to the film industry. Your great uncle Henry, for instance, side hustles as a driver and fixer for film crews, even as he's working on the plantation and contending with strike actions. Can you tell us more about your interest in exploring these intersecting economies, or they're intersecting and they're also historical, of plantation, film, and tourism?
Yeah, I think what connects them all is they're extractive, where they're taking something and it's not a regenerative process. So sugar, it's breaking down the cane, refining it in California. For Hollywood, it's shooting on the location, editing in California. And it's something that, even to this day, the productions aren't really, that's still the general thrust of how films are made. The crew comes, then they leave. Sugar that was done in this way that was not sustainable to the land, and then it moved on. And then tourism, it's the same thing. It's not a, they have to ship in food and supplies to mm-hmm. supplement the tourism influx. And I think that there was, with my great uncle, and also you see his friend, the labor leader at the time, there was no expectation that their experience would really be explored in any way. They were just kind of, they would accommodate this crew and the story they wanted to tell. And they didn't really think twice about, when I speak to Ernesto, it's, I ask him, is there I ask him about the ILWU. It's like, you seek out films on Hawaii? And he's kind of like, about the ILWU? And he's like, oh no, I was in a film, but he ends up being an extra to, this Kevin Costner film. And, in reality, the story of organizing in the ILWU would be to make a fantastic film, especially in like the 30s. It'd be a rich story with all these conflicts, but he never thought that would even be something of interest. And meanwhile, we have... Mike Faya, who's talking about, my family's very conscious of how we're presented on film because he expected to see himself or some form of his family or his interests or his background reflected in these films, either through Diamond Head or he talks about The Descendants, which he saw himself as, part of this amalgamation of the Descendants is the film with George Clooney, and it talks about the owner, having this conflicted relationship as being a landowner on Hawaii, and he saw, this is a conflicted thing, and he saw his whole story kind of reflected, but so that was interesting to see from that point of view.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a documentary, your film is replete with all manner of documents, photographs, historical photographs, archival materials, oral history and testimony, excerpts from classic Hollywood films that we've discussed, family and home movies, and so on. But it's the absence of a record of that of your great uncle Henry's performance in Cane Fire that becomes the kind of engine for the film, The Search. Why was the absence of this film important to your exploration of political life in a settler colony? Why was that the trigger for you?
Yeah, I think it started with... again, looking at all the record of all the films shot on Kauai, and it was known that there was this lost film, and it was filmed on this plantation, and
Lois Weber of all things.
And Lois Weber, yeah, and her story, and which if you're not familiar with her work, definitely someone you should seek out as a pioneer filmmaker. This was her last film, her first talking film, last film. I don't think people are still looking for it. I'm sure it'll be found eventually, but so far it's still lost. And there was a lot of people that were actively seeking it out because for different reasons. Because whether it was the family that hosted the filmmakers, or film historians, or people that wanted to know what was the like as a record of what plantation life was like then. And so it kind of became a way to, like a talking point to conversation starter, to be like, oh, you've heard of this film? And then we would talk about films, and then, well, what's your association, or what films do you think of? And so what started is kind of this detective mission kind of broke away, because it didn't really matter eventually if it was found or not. It was more like the journey, I guess, along the way. That's kind of how it came about, and what kind of was the through line?
Well, the film has a critical tone throughout, but its sharpest edge comes when you imagine an alternative ending to the lost film Cane Fire, where the plantation isn't burned as the result of a lover's quarrel, but as the result of an island-wide uprising of indigenous people and migrant workers. It's an unapologetic and obviously very incendiary moment in the film that turns various Hollywood productions against themselves in the service of a radically different political agenda. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure, yeah.
The alternative ending.
Sure, yeah. I had but three things that were going through my mind on that. The first was this trying to recreate the climax of this lost film. And like, what was the thing that, you know, really disturbed film censors and disturbed plantation owners of this revolt that happened, or what they felt was too closely associated with it. And so I imagine like the worst fears of like the worst anxieties of the owners. And this is something that, you know, connects to many cultures that are harvesting cane. There's songs about, you know, will the plantation burn down? There's this anxiety. And you know, I also was drawn to the actual record of the Hanapepe massacre. Mm-hmm. Of, you know, there was it's still being, you know, more facts about what actually happened on that day when the workers, you know, 16 workers were killed. What were the circumstances? But reading the record of Pablo Manlapit organizing the workers, there was no intention of violence. They didn't show up with weapons. They went through this long deliberation. It was very long and boring. And this is kind of what I'm getting back to my third point, is that, but there was so much anxiety and prejudice really against the Filipino workers that they were gonna turn violent with the owners, that they immediately approached the strike with guns drawn and, you know, was ready to engage. And the same exact thing happened with the Hilo massacre about 10 years later, where people were completely unarmed and the hired police opened fire on the workers. And so it was kind of playing on that, you know, this fear and this prejudice. And the third part is really just how mundane and actual organizing is in such a long view that, you know, this kind of fantasy of this resolution is just, you know, it's just a film fantasy, you know. Those clips I'm pulling from are B movies, and I have an appreciation for B movies where they get to the core of things in a really, you know, visceral way that has its own purpose, and you know, people see it and they can say, oh, this is a funny fantasy or harnesses a certain energy, but that was the purpose of that.
Yeah, great. Since many of your subjects are members of your extended family, much of that footage comes from home movies. But there's also another form of home movie here, that of the tourist video, which appears, I think, twice. A short passage where we see a woman boarding a shuttle to Kmart, you know, come to the islands and go to Kmart. And another where we see a pair of tourists from a cruise ship who are very off-putting. But both of these passages are intimate, although they cut in the opposite direction, tonally and otherwise. So, two questions. How did you go about obtaining the tourist footage? And second, what is at stake for you as a filmmaker in telling a broad social and political history through the intimate relations of your own family?
Yeah, I think that the whole approach I wanted to be very kaleidoscopic, where you're getting all these different forms of representation of media happening, and you have Yeah, oral histories, you have plantation archives, you have Hollywood films, you have officially constructed tourism ads, you have user-generated media. And that was interesting to me, that whole phenomenon of how the people would take these themes, or they would themes from the golden era of Hollywood, and carry it into their own media and create their own visions, and were showing, you know, their own comfort with presenting themselves in this way. And, you know, on the very basic level with the Kmart video, it was like, I wanted to move through from getting from the ship to Cocoa Palms. I wanted to move there through whatever source to get there. So it was going from the woman with the, you know, going onto the van drives off, and then we basically get to Cocoa Palms. And so it was almost, that's just kind of this, like, yeah, this journey I wanted, like, that you could really just jump in any direction. And, you know, the more you jumped in different points of view, the more jarring it was, and the more kind of, you know, obscene it feels. With the second video, you know, that's really, for a long period of time, every week I would just put in Kauai into the YouTube and just go through, and really that video was kind of the tip of the iceberg of so much that was indicative of that style. And it seemed to really perfectly encapsulate this, like, total comfort or shamelessness, just make yourself, you know, just completely, just no, never a second thought to interacting with others. And just, you know, that really just felt like a perfectly self-encapsulated moment. I didn't want to draw it out too much or have a compilation. Like, I just wanted to kind of show, okay, well, this is the norm. Like, when you, this is how people are encouraged to behave, and no one can really counter that for them to feel comfortable that way.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it was very cringeworthy. You show how the powers of colonialism flow not only through historical processes, but through intimate relationships, to follow up on what we were just talking about. To take one example that stands out for me, it's the when you interview the president of the Realtors Board, Chad, what's his name? Anyways, his name is Chad. He gets emotional when speaking about his move to Kauai, telling you that even though he's never been there before, the second he arrives, he knows he's home, which is then amplified by the story he tells about being embraced by a local woman, and this is what actually makes him get emotional. This deep sense of affection and connection, of course, then transforms into a life built around possession. The president of the Realtors Board tells us something like 50% of the housing units on Kauai are either second homes or investment properties, and we see a little of that. Can you say more about how these intimate and personal feelings, and by various players in the film, feelings of affection, love, and care relate to the structural domination of colonialism? Because he seems much like the tourist that you're talking about in the random video you found on Google with them, you know, him pretending to sing in the language and just being very obtuse. And here you have the same, this guy, the president, he's very emotional, you know, he's not doing it for business or to make a living. This is because he cares. Could you say more?
Yeah, so Chad Deal. His name
yeah,
is.
That's right. I kept thinking Chad Deal. I kept thinking Bad Deal.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so yeah, Chad Deal was at the time the president of the Board of Realtors of Kauai. And, you know, I think I wanted to make it important to talk to a wide group of people. And, you know, I thought it was fair to challenge him in his position. And I wasn't there to, you know, police bad behavior. I just thought that he really hit this certain ideology that was really embraced. It's embraced by the state. And I think there's so much of a theme of people building their own myths of what their connection is to the land. And I think he and other people that are wealthy transplants would look down on the tourist as like, oh, this is obscene and tacky. But we have this like more profound connection to the land, but it's not really reciprocal. It's not, you know, they're not really giving, you know, this aloha spirit that's mentioned twice. You know, it's first mentioned by the Cocoa Palms developer, and then it's mentioned again by Chad Deal. It's, you know, something that has meaning, but it's been, perverted basically by, you know, it's one way. It's not a true reciprocal relationship with the Hawaiian people. It's more kind of building this comfort. Okay, what is my relationship? And you know, what do I tell myself of what my relationship is? And you know, there's people like my own family as immigrant settlers. You know, they are totally open to be introspective on this. But this kind of myth that everything is right and good was very interesting to watch. And I think the emotion part, I don't even know, you know, he sees, you know, he gets emotional because he wants to, you know, there's a sense of belonging. Like there is a pathos, like it's not totally ridiculous, but no. You kind of, it's like so much wrapped up. And I think that was an important moment to kind of this conflicted emotion that he was feeling.
Yeah. Since you made the film, Hawaii has experienced a devastating fire event with the catastrophic wildfire that hit Maui and more or less destroyed the town of Lahaina. I wonder if you could help us understand your film in this new context. Is there a difference or a connection between the fire you imagine in your film and the so-called wildfire that so devastated Maui?
Yeah, so there was a recent wildfire in Lahaina that over 100 people were killed. It was people are still displaced. There's thousands of people that are actually living in hotels that lost their homes. I have two cousins that lost their homes. Everyone is safe, but it impacted a lot of people, a lot of Native Hawaiians, a lot of Filipino homeowners. And, you know, it's still ongoing, so I don't want to comment on, you know, I didn't spend much time in Maui, so I don't want to speak too much beyond. But to link to, I guess, the film you just saw thematically, that Alexander and Baldwin, one of the big five sugar companies that I follow through four generations on Kauai, they were the major landowners on Maui that are directly implicated in this fire, because once that the sugar company closed down, they just left the fields with this, you know, very flammable grass. You know, temperatures have gone up because of climate change, and so now there's way more fire risk than there used to be in the previous years. Mm-hmm. And so it's a mix of that, and also, you know, in the film, when I talked about the water being diverted by the plantations, this was actually, there was another consequence of Maui's total water table is thrown off, and places are much more drier than they used to be and susceptible. And, you know, there was a conflict with uses of the water still to this day. It's, you know, many of the plantations have just, instead of returning the water to, you know, ancestral families, they're actually, you know, just diverting it to another extractive economy. Is it a golf course? Is it tourism? Or, you know, hotels? And so that was really, you know, in a wider scope, it's very fresh. These are kind of these bigger themes that people are grappling with. And, you know, people are more apt to draw these connections, I think. And unfortunately, on top of that, you know, the realty, it's so predatory. After the initial fire was put out and the properties were still smoldering, they had, you know, realtors come in and really try to offer, you know, buy people out of their property and take advantage of the situation. You know, very, in the model, like Naomi Klein, the writer, talks about, you know, disaster capitalism, taking advantage of a natural disaster occurs, and then how does someone try to profit from that? So that's something what they're dealing with right now, and it hasn't been resolved yet. And you know, the people that were displaced are still, you know, they froze rent for a while, but it's still being negotiated how they're going to be taken care of. And
wow. Let's talk a little bit more about the tourism industry, which is now the dominant industry on the islands. You know, for instance, what do we make of Uncle Larry, who was a plantation worker, but who ends up as an entertainer at the Coco Palms and even plays music at the announcement of the hotel's redevelopment, which is a little bit troubling, given that the narration accompanies it from the young activist maintaining an occupation at the site. Mm-hmm. As a documentarian, how did you go about keeping this space of negotiation and complexity open for your subjects, even as you obviously develop your own line of critique?
Yeah, Uncle Larry, Larry Rivera, I have a lot of respect for. And, you know, he has such an amazing life. I mean, what an incredible story. And he's, you know, he unfortunately passed away earlier. But
he promises at the beginning, he just keeps getting worse.
Yeah, and that was, yeah, he's just that humor that he has and graciousness. And he's just a really loving person. And, you know, I think everything he says comes from a place of love and concern for people. He's seeing this suffering and people saying, okay, we need to solve this by jobs. We need jobs for this is the way we're going to solve this issue, because that's how he grew up. And he thought this is the way to the best way, approach. And, you know, it was hard when, to make that call when he started speaking publicly about it. And I was thinking, well, he doesn't have to comment on this, you know, he doesn't have to testify on behalf, but he was really pushed by the developers because they were promising him that, you know, this would be a good thing for the community. And I can get into more how that kind of backfired or how that didn't play out. But, you know, that was something that he believed in, and he meant the best. I think it's funny, when I was showing it to local audiences in Kauai, when they saw Larry Rivera, they were, you know, like everyone loves Larry. And then I was like, when it came to that part in the courtroom, it wasn't this betrayal or this sudden turn or nasty feeling. It was kind of like an uncle that you loved, you know, says something embarrassing at Thanksgiving, and they were just like, oh, okay, that's, you know. Yeah, people challenged him on that. And, you know, I think that he's still, I think his memory is still, I mean, he's still a beloved figure of Kauai that people remember fondly.
Yes. So the cocoa palms is such a rich and important symbol for the film. It's this place where questions of representation and fantasy coincide materially with the realities of land enclosure, indigenous dispossession, racialized labor, exploitation, the outsized power of the tourist industry. Do you have any updates on the status of the Cocoa Palms development and the ongoing efforts on the part of the Kanaka Maoli to rehabilitate and reclaim the site?
Yeah, so the owners that you see in the film, they defaulted on their loan a couple years after. And that was after they totally removed everyone who was on the property. So now it's, you know, they destroyed any sort of farm work that the activists did, but it's back to complete to zero. And, you know, the property was open for sale for a while. A new developer came in, then they dropped out, and now there's a group that's trying to come in and bring it to a nonprofit's coming in. They want to make it a cultural center, but then it's kind of up to debate who would have control of that of the land. But this recent developer that came out, I guess to mention, connecting it to what I was saying about Larry, was new hotels that are opening are not able to offer employment that meets the standard of living there. I mean, and you know, this was the promise of the, every time a developer came, they said, okay, this is a job creator. But this latest developer says, you know, this is a job creator. And then once there was any pushback, they said, well, we'll just bring in people from the outside. Like, we don't need local people to work here. And that was a big mistake, because that was the one thing that people were holding on to. And another hotel recently opened as well that they can't hire staff, because it's just on a bare minimum, the housing, there's just no way to actually live on the island with that level of wage. And so the paradigm has really shifted, I think, even in the last 5 years. It used to be this inevitability that there couldn't be anything but a hotel, like there just wasn't going to be anything else. And now public opinion has switched, where most people, I'd say the majority, I think there was a poll recently on Kauai, said, you know, this should be a cultural center or nothing at all, or there's no reason for this hotel development here. So that's where it's at right now.
Well, I think we're ready to open up for audience questions. I'm going to turn things over to my colleague, Emily Zinn, who will give you directions on how to ask questions, because we want to have them recorded. Emily.
At the beginning of the movie, you talk a lot about how, as a child when you visited Kauai, you felt different from your cousins or almost isolated, like they refer to you as like the white boy of your family. How did staying on Kauai with family deepen your connection to your family and your family's culture?
Thank you for that question. It's very interesting. I think that I went in as a, I just always kind of had this awkward outsider feeling, and this was a great way to reconnect. But I don't think that that there was some fundamental elements of a relationship that still weren't going to be crossed. It wasn't as if I was fully going to feel like I was I suddenly felt like I lived there my whole life. I knew that was always going to be a bit of a disconnect. My relationship really strengthened with my cousin Sandy, who you see in the film, because she was always, she's so knowledgeable about everything that's going on. And so much of this film came out of these long nights of just talking ideas. And she's just so open-minded. And, that really, I think she really appreciated that exchange. And there's a trust there that, going into this next project, she's more actively involved. I think with my cousins, they were figuring out what was important in their lives. So it was kind of talking through just kind of in a general way. And I think there was appreciation if they were closer to my age that I could say, hey, I'm going through the same things, or my friends are going through similar things. And you're not alone in this feeling like you're overwhelmed, that you're putting in all the work, but you're not able to see the results that maybe your family did. And maybe they don't understand because of, they had an easier time, or, circumstances made it more accessible for them. So I think there's an appreciation now and more of a trust. But, and of course, with my great uncle Henry, he and I immediately got along because we saw very eye to eye politically, and he was someone who would always just, again, like to my cousin Sandy, just was, even at his age, was just totally open-minded and let me kind of share my side. And he was just always actively learning and actively curious. And, it was something that I really appreciated and it helped me connect to other people on the island and more family members.
So in the earlier part of the film and stuff, you use a lot of archival footage and images and documents and whatever. So I was kind of wondering, what was your process in sort of finding these like documents and then implementing them into the film?
Yeah, there was different routes and different sources. Some of it was because this was such a long filming process, was almost like a crate digging for samples, where someone would say, hey, I got this great group of photos that you can use, and I didn't know what the if it fit into the film, but I always filed it away in a very vast archive and didn't know how it was going to piece together. For Hollywood films, it was finding out online the downloads and then replacing them eventually, but having this kind of, this basic archive to pull from. Some of it was from the Kauai Historical Society. Some was from the Grove Farm Museum. And the Kauai Historical Society was interesting because they're a great group, but they are so understaffed that all this material would be coming in that they wouldn't even be able to file it. And so some of the photos that you see in here was them just like letting me go on. Like there was a stack of photos in the closet, and I would just be going through for hours and find something that was relevant to my own research or who I talked to. Like, for example, when you see the black and white photos of the housing development of, after the plantation camps, people building houses, I had read about that many years, but I had never seen any documentation of that in a book or anywhere else. And it was through this, random box of photos, totally unmarked, that I found that, a collection of photos. So it was just really a slow process. It was kind of finding things that were unmarked and seeing how they fit in.
Thanks for making the video. I'm quite impressed. I'm first generation here in California from the Philippines. So I have stories of friends who are Hawaii. Grandmother was there. She was born there, so she's a citizen. Other people were not. And in the Navy, it's like, you're here, you're from Hawaii. It's fun. When did you start the making this? And then are you going to go back, follow up? What happens in Kauai? Thank you.
Thank you for that question. I started filming in 2014, on and off then. And yeah, it actually, it kind of came from, I had done a short documentary about the Domino Sugar Factory in Brooklyn, New York, and I was following two former sugar workers, and they were going back to the building after the business had closed down. And it was in that process of learning about the history of the sugar industry that I was making more of a connection. I knew my family was involved, but I didn't know the specifics of it. And I didn't know how, you know, my family in Puerto Rico made it to Hawaii. It was always because through the sugar trade, where they were extracting sugar that was being imported to Domino Sugar in Brooklyn. But then when a hurricane destroyed the field in Puerto Rico, then they moved from Puerto Rico to Hawaii to continue working in sugar. And so that all kind of connected. And, you know, it was a self-funded, self-shot project that was kind of on and off whenever I had time on that period of 6 years. And I am continuing a few projects. One's a companion of sorts where I'm looking at a group of farmers that are actually taking over former plantation farmland, and they're of Native Hawaiian descent, to kind of create this regenerative farming movement, thinking about political sovereignty through food sovereignty, and you know, something that is on a lot of people's minds, especially after feeling more vulnerable in the last couple of years.
Well, thank you very much. Please join me in thanking Anthony Banua Simon for being with us tonight and for showing his film, Cane Fire. It's been really great to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrice. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.